Today is Tuesday, September 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden criticized U.S. President Donald Trump for his response to recent acts of violence.
His failure to call on his own supporters to stop acting as an armed militia in this country shows how weak he is.
Plus, an exclusive interview with Belarus's opposition leader.
This political crisis that takes place in our country is absolutely internal affair.
And China institutes universal COVID-19 testing in Hong Kong. We'll have these stories and more next. Racial tensions in the United States have taken center stage in the upcoming presidential election following deadly confrontations between Black Lives Matter protesters and white supporters of President Trump. VOA's Brian Patton starts us off.
Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden on Monday blamed President Trump for deadly violence over the weekend after Trump supporters in Portland, Oregon, clashed with racial equality advocates.
He may believe mouthing the words law and order makes him strong, but his failure to call on his own supporters to stop acting as an armed militia in this country shows how weak he is.
On Saturday in Portland, one person was shot and killed following confrontations between a caravan of Trump supporters, some of them armed, and Black Lives Matter demonstrators who have held nightly protests for the last 3 months. The shooting victim in Portland was affiliated with a conservative activist group called Patriot Prayer. President Trump called the counter-protesters in Portland who support him great patriots on Twitter Sunday. Last week in Kenosha, Wisconsin, a Trump supporter shot 3 people, 2 fatally, during protests that erupted there after a black man was shot in the back 7 times during a confrontation with police. At the Republican National Convention, President Trump denounced racial equality demonstrators as anarchists and criticized Democrats for condoning violence committed by these groups to maintain support from African American voters.
If the Democrat Party wants to stand with anarchists, agitators, rioters, looters, and flag burners, that is up to them. But I, as your president, will not be a part of it.
Biden on Monday strongly denounced any violence committed by supporters or opponents.
It's lawlessness, plain and simple. And those who do it should be prosecuted. Violence will not bring change. It'll only bring destruction.
President Trump is planning to visit Kenosha this week, even though Wisconsin's Democratic Governor Tony Evers urged him not to come, saying in a letter, "Your presence will only delay our work to overcome division." Portland's Democratic Mayor Ted Wheeler also criticized Trump for allegedly fomenting hate and division in the country. Trump called Wheeler a fool on Twitter for not calling in the National Guard to restore order. Biden has tried to make Trump's inability to contain the coronavirus pandemic the primary campaign issue. It is unclear whether Trump's law and order focus will change the dynamics of the race. But polls now show Biden's lead over Trump shrinking in key swing states like Michigan and Pennsylvania. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
France's President Emmanuel Macron arrived in Beirut hours after Lebanese leaders named diplomat Mustafa Adib as the new prime minister on Monday under French pressure. Macron also addressed the Lebanese people in an Arabic language tweet, saying that he had returned as promised to work together to create necessary conditions for reconstruction and stability. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Joe Macaron, a senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, about the French pressure on Lebanon.
Since the Beirut explosion happened, the French policy felt the need to fill the power vacuum. At the end of the day, Lebanon is one of the last countries of influence for France. And there was fear that maybe Iranian or Turkish will fill this vacuum. In particular, given the competition between France and Turkey and the Eastern Mediterranean. So there was this French very clear pressure on the political class in Lebanon after the explosion in Beirut, move on with reform. And there was some sort of also U.S. support for this international mandate led by France. So now there's a follow-up visit to remind the Lebanese leaders what's the benchmark for reform, what's demanded from them, from the international community.
A French presidency source said Macron was demanding a government of mission, clean, efficient, and able to implement the necessary reforms in Lebanon. Would this pressure produce a functional, nonpartisan government in Lebanon?
The early indications are not very encouraging. Mustafa Adib, the name prime minister, was basically parachuted to Lebanese politics. He has no experience in public governance at this level. He was named outside of Lebanese institutions without any understanding of the Lebanese public mood at that time. So he's a product of the political class. He's one of the public servants who was serving lately as an ambassador in Germany. And he doesn't show any indication that he might be willing or able to lead such a reform. I think the main thing is who the minister he will pick, what kind of platform the government will have, and what it will be able to accomplish. But for now, it's just the remaking of a political class that's trying to cut losses and just get a different face that could lead this unprecedented crisis in Lebanese history.
A spokesperson from the International Monetary Fund said, "We welcome the nomination of a new prime minister in Lebanon and hope that a new government will be formed shortly with a mandate to implement policies and reforms that Lebanon needs to address the current crisis and restore sustainable growth. Is a loan from the IMF enough as a first step to improve the economic situation in Lebanon?"
A loan from the IMF alone is not enough. As we have seen in the past few months, the previous government has negotiated with the IMF for months, and these talks have stalled. So now we have to see what's the approach of the new government. And the history has taught us that an IMF loan without a real economic and or reform plan will backfire and will not be very popular among the citizens, because they will be asked to make large sacrifices. And the Lebanese people believe at this point that they should not alone take this burden. So the question is whether a deep government's form, will it have the willingness and the capability to lead such an ambitious project for Lebanon?
Joe Mekaron is a senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, and he was speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. The remaining signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal met in Vienna Tuesday. They were trying to save the faltering agreement as the United States urges international sanctions to be placed on Tehran. Nicholas Pinot provides this update on those discussions.
The meeting is chaired by EU senior official Helga Schmid, with representatives from Britain, China, France, Germany, Iran, and Russia, attending to save the landmark 2015 accord with Iran, which has been progressively stepping up its nuclear activities since last year. In a boost to today's talks, the Iranian Atomic Energy last week agreed to allow inspectors of the UN nuclear watchdog to visit two sites suspected of having hosted undeclared activity in the early 2000s. International Atomic Energy Agency head Rafael Grossi had traveled to Iran on his first trip since taking up the top post last year and after a month of calling for access. Results from any site visits are expected to take up to 3 months, according to a diplomat familiar with the matter. So it risks being a problem then with the Iranians if anything undeclared and nuclear-related is found. Tehran insists it is entitled to do so under the deal, which swapped sanctions relief for Iran's agreement to scale back its nuclear program, following the U.S. withdrawal from the accord in 2018 and the reimposition of sanctions. The United Nations last week blocked a U.S. bid to reimpose international sanctions on Iran, while Washington also failed to rally enough support to extend an arms embargo set to lapse in October. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo blasted the Security Council's failure to hold Iran accountable in a statement. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya recently spoke with the Voice of America. Henry Ridgewell has that story.
Svetlana Tikhanovskaya has been thrust into the global spotlight. The figurehead of the Belarusian opposition, a 37-year-old woman standing up to Alexander Lukashenko, known as Europe's last dictator. Yet Tikhanovskaya told VOA she does not seek international help.
This political crisis that takes place in our country is absolutely internal affair, and we have Belarusian people have responsibility for what's going on, and we think that we have to solve this problem by ourselves.
Their solution so far: people power. Tens of thousands of protesters have taken to the streets since the August 9th election, demanding the resignation of President Lukashenko. He claimed victory with 80% of the vote. The opposition, along with the United States and the European Union, say the vote was heavily rigged. Hundreds of protesters have been arrested, and there is widespread evidence of abuse and torture. Tsikhanouskaya fled to neighbouring Lithuania after the election, fearing for her family's safety, but refused to elaborate further.
I had big reasons to make this step. I can't talk about this now. Maybe somewhere in the future I will talk of them, all my story, but now I can't comment on it.
Now Tsikhanouskaya is trying to coordinate a roadmap for Belarus's future. The Kremlin has invited Lukashenko to Moscow in the coming days. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he has a police reserve force ready to intervene in Belarus. Tsikhanouskaya stood for the presidency after the May arrest of her husband, popular video blogger Sergei Tikhanovsky, who had planned to take part. The wives of other opposition figures offered her their support. Thousands of women have joined the anti-government protests in recent days. The protests have drawn comparisons with those in neighboring Ukraine in 2014 that led to the overthrow of President Viktor Yanukovych. Then the colors of the European Union flag filled Independence Square as the opposition courted Western support. Russia responded by annexing Crimea and invading eastern Ukraine. In contrast, Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya has, for now, explicitly rejected any outside intervention. Across the border in her home country, the protesters continue to defy the government. Their future and the political fortunes of Tikhanouskaya remain highly uncertain. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News.
And coming up later,
Japan's top government spokesman Yoshihide Suga is now a strong frontrunner to become the country's next leader after Prime Minister Shinzo Abe announced last Friday that he would resign due to health issues.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
The temperature of the sun's surface is thought to be between 5 to 10,000 degrees Celsius. As the sun's energy makes its way up from its surface through its atmosphere, that temperature is amplified to between a half million to over a million degrees Celsius at the top layer of its atmosphere, or corona. A group of researchers at India's National Center for Radioastrophysics say they may have found what causes this solar heat amplification phenomenon. The scientists say they recently discovered numerous tiny flashes of radio light from all over the sun, which they determined to be small magnetic explosions. They theorize that while each of these little explosions are quite weak, the combined power of them all is what helps ramp up the corona's blazing hot temperature. A study published in the astrophysical journal Letters details the findings. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The global coronavirus pandemic has infected over 25.5 million people, according to statistics compiled by Johns Hopkins University in the U.S. This includes over 6 million cases in the United States alone, nearly 4 million in Brazil, and almost 3.7 million in India. The university also attributes over 850,000 deaths to COVID-19 and says that 16.8 million people have recovered from the coronavirus. Hong Kong began free coronavirus testing for all of its residents on Tuesday, and I spoke with reporter Ria Mogul in Hong Kong about the program.
Hong Kong has been going through its third wave of COVID infections. We've done actually, you know, pretty well in keeping the number of infections at bay, you know, considering that we are about 1,000 kilometers from Wuhan, which was the sort of epicenter of the outbreak and where everything happened. But in over the past maybe 2-3 months, we've experienced a pretty, you know, horrific third wave for Hong Kong standards, where we saw, you know, triple digit infections per day. So for that, for those reasons, the government have decided to implement this voluntary mass testing scheme. So the goal is to ultimately test I guess, all 7.5 million Hong Kong residents. And, you know, we've seen similar schemes implemented in other countries, South Korea, for example.
Speaking of South Korea, one of the most iconic pictures during their mass testing was, of course, the drive-through process, which they pioneered. That's not something that exactly can happen in Hong Kong. So what's the plan to get these tests conducted?
Right. So there are, it's not a drive-through test like South Korea, but there are several centers dispersed across the city, and people have to sign up online, I imagine, based on their district. So they'll go to the one closest to them and just show up and get tested. And today was the first day that it's happened. And from all the news reports and from all the firsthand accounts that I've seen so far, it's pretty smooth sailing for everyone that has voluntarily signed up to go get tested. You have to queue in line, you know, be socially distant. And most people have been out of testing centers in minutes. But a reason for this, I guess, is because not many people have signed up. Since registrations began, only a fraction of Hong Kong people, about 7%, have signed up to get tested voluntarily.
I understand that registration is still open, so the government is hoping that more people will take advantage of this testing. But I also understand there's a lot of concern about how the personal data will be used.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the Hong Kong government have involved and asked for help from a number of mainland Chinese firms and doctors to help with this mass testing. And this has led to a lot of fears of harvesting of data and DNA of Hong Kong people, you know, as Beijing continues to crack down on calls for democracy reform in Hong Kong. In fact, an alliance of healthcare workers, district councillors, pro-democracy activists, including Joshua Wong, they've all urged Hong Kong citizens to boycott the testing completely. You know, LegCo elections were also supposed to be held just in 5 days on September 6th. And that's been postponed for at least a year. And people are very angry that, well, you've got these mass testing sites and people are going to gather in the thousands, but you've canceled elections whereby people could have gone to cast their vote.
Rio Mogul reports from Hong Kong. In Japan, top government spokesman Yoshihide Suga has won the backing of the ruling party's largest faction and may become the country's next leader. Reuters' Gloria So has the details.
Japan's top government spokesman Yoshihide Suga is now a strong frontrunner to become the country's next leader after Prime Minister Shinzo Abe announced last Friday that he would resign due to health issues. It was first reported on Tuesday that Suga has now won the backing of the ruling party's largest faction. Suga is Japan's chief cabinet secretary and Abe's longtime lieutenant, and he is widely expected to continue the policy course set out by Abe, including the Abenomics strategy aimed at reviving the economy and keeping it afloat during the global health crisis. Suga has not yet publicly announced his candidacy for leader of the Liberal Democratic Party, but a source tells Reuters he has indicated privately that he intends to run, and media reports said he would formally announce his intention to run on Wednesday. Party Secretary General Toshihiro Nakai said LDP executives agreed to a simplified vote by party MPs from both chambers of parliament and heads of local chapters. That's despite younger LDP legislators presenting a demand for a wider full-scale vote on Monday. The party is expected to hold its leadership vote on September 14th. The party's leader will almost certainly become prime minister because of its majority in the lower house of parliament.
That was Reuters reporter Gloria So. Former Japanese defense minister Shigeru Ishiba announced that he will also be running for the leadership of Japan's ruling party and said that he regretted ordinary party members will be unable to vote. Ishiba is a favorite to lead the Liberal Democratic Party in opinion polls, but the slimmed-down version of the election that officials have announced is widely expected to work against him. Thai police arrested a student leader Tuesday as part of a continued crackdown against political activists who helped organize an anti-government protest in July. Reporter Stephen Boitano gave me the details from Bangkok.
The arrest today was a young 21-year-old Jutip Sirikon, and she was president of a student union of Thailand. And she's also a leader in a group, a free youth group, which has expanded now into a free people group. So it's not necessarily all youth. And yeah, she was arrested for a Democracy Monument rally. And they got her for breaching internal security, coronavirus bans on public gatherings. Her arrest is just, it's ongoing. It's an ongoing saga of week after week arrests of of leaders, student leaders, or perceived student leaders. You know, there's been rappers that have been arrested. Anyone that's showing any dissent towards the government, they're getting arrested.
Is that the common thread, just dissent towards the government? You know, what was the impetus for all of these protests that have been going on for, you know, for some time now?
Right. I mean, you know, they want, I mean, there's like three main demands. They've been, a lot of the protests have been requested. They want a new constitution. They want an end of the government intimidation of, you know, of government critics. And they want a dissolution of parliament. I mean, they want the prime minister to step down, and the army has taken, you know, with a new constitution, they've taken control of the government.
Well, so I mean, that's what they're calling for. And, you know,
right,
the authorities in charge are opposed to that because they are arresting and detaining these student leaders and other leaders who are speaking out. But what is the overall support across the country for these kinds of proposed changes?
The young people, they want the change. The students are all for it. They're looking for these changes. Overall support, I mean, it's growing. I think there's been polls taken, and the majority of people do support the student protesters and what they're doing.
Is there any sign that the protests are going to let up? Are the crackdowns enough to stunt the effort, or are they just increasing in frequency and increasing in scope?
Yeah, they are. They're happening more and more. Yeah, it's getting bigger and bigger. More numbers of people are coming out, and it doesn't show any sign of letting up. You know, and a lot of this has to do with the economy, which is really suffering. You know, with the coronavirus lockdowns, there's no tourists, foreign tourists coming into Thailand. And this is really hurting a lot of people. And everyone's frustrated with the government. You know, the government had a lapse weeks ago of some people got in with coronavirus, got into the population that were supposed to be under quarantine, and it leaked out and everybody freaked out. And that kind of initiated a lot of, you know, open resentment and anger towards the government.
Stephen Boitano reports from Bangkok, Thailand. And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month marks the 7th anniversary of the deadly chemical weapons attack on Ghouta, Syria. On August 21st, 2013, in the Damascus suburbs, the regime of Bashar al-Assad gassed more than 1,400 Syrians, many of them children, with the chemical agent known as sarin. In memory of the victims of that brutality, the United States announced 6 sanctions against the Assad regime's military, government, and financial supporters. The U.S. has imposed sanctions on Assad's henchman, Yasser Ibrahim, under Executive Order 13894, for his efforts to obstruct a political solution to the Syrian conflict. Using his networks across the Middle East and beyond, Ibrahim has cut corrupt deals that enrich Assad, while Syrians are dying from a lack of food and medicine. The U.S. has also designated, pursuant to Executive Order 13894, leadership of several Syrian military units for their efforts to prevent a ceasefire in Syria. In the National Defense Forces, the U.S. has designated Commander Fadi Sakhar. In the 4th Division, 42nd Brigade Commander Brigadier General Gaith Dalla was also designated. Finally, in the Tiger Forces, the U.S. has designated the Haider Regiment Commander Samer Ismail. These senior officials lead the same Syrian military that has killed children with barrel bombs and used chemical weapons against communities like Ghouta, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. They have shattered the social contract between citizens and the military sworn to protect them. Since June 2020, the United States has designated over 55 individuals who have perpetrated Assad's brutal policies. These new sanctions memorialize the victims of Assad's chemical weapons attack on Ghouta 7 years ago, said Secretary Pompeo on Twitter. We will not stop pressing for accountability and a peaceful solution to the Syrian conflict.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.